Hello, my name is Nathan Myers, and this is the first episode of a new podcast that I'm starting called Policy versus Pandemics. So I just wanted to take a few minutes on my own to just kind of talk about why I started the podcast and what I hope to accomplish with it. The mission of the podcast is to highlight and explore in an interdisciplinary way current policies that are designed to prevent and control pandemics. I also want to look at some innovative policy proposals that have been made to take new approaches to prevent and control pandemics. Another objective of the podcast is to highlight the work of advocates and organizations who work on pandemic preparedness and global health policy in general. And then finally, I want to, again, really emphasize the work of individuals in the field who are actually implementing policy to prevent and control pandemics. So what I hope this podcast will be is a place where there can be an integrated and interdisciplinary community where those with expertise or interest in public policy and pandemic preparedness can come together to share their views on supporting efforts to promote pandemic preparedness at the local, state, national, as well as the international level. So the goals that I hope to achieve with the podcast, I want to regularly interview experts or practitioners in the field to get their views on the latest developments in pandemic policy and what the priorities should be in this area moving forward. I want to highlight significant items in the news related to the intersection between pandemic preparedness and policy and how these developments speak to the value of interdisciplinary work in this space. I want to explore the intersection between pandemic preparedness policy and policy in related fields, such as biodefense and community resilience. While these are all unique areas in and of themselves, there's much work that's being done in each of those domains that obviously contributes to the other two and to global health in general. And then finally, I want to focus on how pandemic preparedness policy, through the collaboration such work can generate, can be a positive space in this area of divisive politics and serve as an area where people of strongly differing ideological perspectives can come together in a bipartisan manner. So, you know, it may sound strange to think of a discussion of pandemic preparedness in kind of an uplifting way. But I do think that this area can be very positive in tone in that it is an area that inspires bipartisan cooperation. There's for example, a biodefense caucus in Congress where a Republican representative, Susan Brooks of Indiana, co-chairs that with a Democratic member of Congress, Anna Eshoo from California. So there is work being done on a bipartisan level to improve the safety of the American public and to protect the American public from major pandemic events or from bioterrorism. And at a time where there's not a lot of cooperation across the aisle, I think that's a very positive and notable thing. So there's already two episodes other than this that have been recorded. Both of those are going to focus on the pandemic preparedness exercise CLADE-X, which was developed and facilitated by the Johns Hopkins University Center for Health Security. The goal of the exercise was to facilitate discussion around the policy challenges that would accompany an outbreak, particularly an outbreak in that situation of a bioengineered pathogen. So through the discussion that was had during that exercise, they explored possible solutions to the challenges that would emerge, and noted gaps in the current system that would make meeting those challenges especially difficult. So as you listen to the two interviews, note that the first interview with Dr. Eric Toner was conducted before CLADEX was actually implemented on May 15th. And then the second interview with Dr. Toner and Dr. Crystal Watson took place after the exercise had been completed and they had had an opportunity to look at some of the data. So there's a before and after aspect there. So what would probably be the best approach in getting the most value out of those interviews would be to listen to the interview with Dr. Eric Toner. If you haven't already watched the CLADEX exercise, which many of you may have already, but if you haven't watched it, listen to the interview with Dr. Toner and kind of get a preview. Go to the website for the Center for Health Security and watch the CLADEX exercise. It is lengthy. It was an all-day exercise, so it does take several hours to get through, so you may have to do it in segments. But it is worth watching in its entirety because it's very informative and highly, highly interesting. And then once you've watched the exercise recording, come back and listen to the second interview and kind of get a perspective on Dr. Toner's reaction and Dr. Watson's reaction once they'd had a chance to look at some of the data. But as you watch the exercise and as you listen to the interviews, I would invite you to look at a number of themes that I think emerge from the exercises and the discussion that it prompted. That ties in very much to the kinds of themes that I want to explore through the podcast. For example, one theme is trust in world leaders to listen to scientific advice, and then connected with that, the effect of mistrust for government and elected officials on the willingness of citizens to follow recommendations. So, you know, a big issue with a hypothetical scenario like CLADEX is you're dealing with a virus, a highly contagious virus, and one that has never been seen before. So in order to get any kind of a handle on the situation, there's going to have to be some extensive studying of the virus, some extensive analysis, and leaders are going to be very dependent on the medical community and the scientific community for information on the virus because there is no pre-existing information. It's not like something like influenza or Ebola where you could go and look at scientific papers. CLADEX would be a situation where there was no pre-existing research. So leaders really would have to trust the scientists. And there is some concern that there's a sizable segment of the elected officials in American government and in other governments around the world that are discounting science when they're making policy, or at least when they're making statements about policy, which is especially troubling for pandemic scenarios like the kind that we're going to be talking about. Also, the level of public trust for government factors in here, because even if elected officials are willing to trust the scientific expertise and make science-based policy, once the government decides to engage in a policy of mass vaccination or something like that, is the public going to go along with that recommendation? Are people going to go and get vaccinated themselves? Are they going to get children vaccinated on the basis of the scientific recommendations as well as the government recommendations? Those are two issues, important issues of trust and how trust can affect the success of policy that I think are worth considering. Another theme is the adequacy of existing policy to help the healthcare and public health systems respond to a pandemic threat. Along with this is the need to maintain trust between healthcare systems and the communities that they serve. So there are a number of policies that are already in existence to try to help both the healthcare and public health systems respond to a major health event. You have the Public Health Emergency Preparedness Cooperative Agreement Program. You have the Hospital Preparedness Program, both of which seeks to foster the creation of collaborations and partnerships to improve pandemic preparedness and the ability to respond if a health event occurs. You have legislation like the Pandemic and All Hazards Preparedness Act, which is currently going through its reauthorization process, which is meant to deal with a range of emergencies, but obviously pandemics is central to what that legislation was trying to prevent. So policy does exist. However, there's the issue of, is that policy adequate? And if it's not adequate to deal with a situation like Claydex, what do we need to do to improve that policy? You know, those are the sorts of discussions going on right now with the PAPA reauthorization discussion. And there are other pieces of legislation that are being proposed at present, which would also deal with some of these situations as well. So, This becomes an issue in the exercise, and it's an issue that we'll talk about in presumably future discussions. Also, this issue of the need to maintain trust between healthcare systems and the communities that they serve, this becomes an issue during the CLADEX exercise because, you know, there are situations that emerge during that hypothetical scenario where hospitals start turning away CLADEX patients, and then also there are situations where communities start to shun healthcare professionals because they're concerned that, you know, these healthcare professionals are connected with or in contact with CLADEX patients, and therefore they might be contagious and might be a threat to the community. So along with these sort of policy-oriented questions of, you know, how do we fund these kinds of responses better? How do we fund prevention work better? There's also sort of cultural or societal questions of how do we promote trust between healthcare systems and the communities so when these situations emerge, they don't break down in the ways that they did during the CLADEX exercise. On an international level, the ability of the World Health Organization or any other international organization to work as an honest broker for resolving disputes in areas such as sharing resources during a pandemic. And going along with this, does the U.S. need better continuity of government planning for overseas bases and embassies in anticipation of a pandemic event? So the first thing, the WHO question. In a previous exercise, the Atlantic Storm exercise, which was conducted in 2005 or 2006, one of the recommendations to come out of that was to use the World Health Organization as kind of an honest broker when trying to resolve questions of how to, you know, how to facilitate the sharing of vaccine. You know, one of the issues was, you know, more developed countries obviously have greater supplies of vaccines, whereas developing countries are at a disadvantage. So, you know, it could become problematic from a political perspective for countries to make decisions about sharing vaccines with the developing world, because there's going to be a certain segment of the population that's going to say, no, these are our resources. We need to keep them in case we need them later. And then you have a situation where even if the G7 countries all agree, you know, on sharing vaccine, you know, how do you enforce those kinds of agreements? The WHO was proposed at the time of the Atlantic Storm exercise to sort of be the organization that could facilitate that kind of activity. In recent years, the World Health Organization's reputation has come into question to some degree. There is the question of the response to Ebola, the issue of the Ebola response perhaps being delayed to some degree, and that costing thousands of lives potentially in Western Africa. So the WHO does not necessarily have the level of international support that it had, you know, a decade ago. The reputation is starting to improve. It seems to be doing a much better job in the response to the most recent Ebola outbreak in Africa and getting a lot of positive attention and positive praise for that. But, you know, there's also the issue of, is any international organization going to really be able to play that role, given the fact that in the U.S. there's a lot of suspicion of international organizations. There's a lot of reaction against the idea of globalism and things like that. And some of those ideas seem to be gaining traction in European countries as well. So even if the WHO or the United Nations more broadly, or some other kind of organization does have the reputation and does have the means, are other countries going to be willing to sort of heed that kind of intervention, or will it be seen as an infringement upon national sovereignty? Focus more specifically on the U.S., another issue that came up during the exercise was this question of, if we have a global pandemic and we have U.S. citizens around the world working at diplomatic embassies and compounds, you know, working in different capacities for different government organizations, you know, other than perhaps the military, kind of taking them out of the equation for a moment, you know, do we evacuate those citizens? Do we bring all of those citizens back to the United States? Would that be good for the United States to do that? Would that be putting even more pressure on our healthcare system? Do we need to keep people around the globe in a diplomatic capacity to be our eyes and ears and to help to facilitate international cooperation? Is it even logistically possible to do those kinds of evacuations in a way that's not going to exacerbate the problem and spread the virus? So those, you know, all those sorts of conversations were had during the CLADEX exercise. And of course, you know, the military is kind of its own unique question. One of the situations that emerged during the CLADEX exercise was a question of tensions in the Middle East, and there, you know, was a conflict that was emerging. Israel had requested that the U.S. come in and provide military assistance in resolving the conflict, but then there's a question of, to what degree is it advisable for military personnel to be actively engaging in military conflict, and even sending additional military personnel around the world in a time of global pandemic? Is that an advisable thing to do? But can the U.S. completely avoid doing that, given that, you know, the U.S. does have a lot of national security interests, defensive interests around the world, and the U.S. military can't just stop defending national security priorities because of a global pandemic? So how do we find the proper balance there? There was a discussion about the role of social media in a situation like CLADEX. how to use social media as a tool to get positive, proactive health messages out to the public, but also how to deal with the problems that social media can present in terms of spreading misinformation and making people fearful or making people suspicious of vaccinations or the real cause of the virus and things like that. So how can we maximize the positive benefit of social media during a pandemic emergency while mitigating the negative consequences that comes from social media? There's also the potential of the weaponization of social media by terrorists, which doesn't necessarily come out during the conversation. This is something I think I asked Dr. Toner and Dr. Watson in the second interview about the potential that if a pandemic or if a health emergency is started by a terrorist group, one of the ways that they could seek to maximize the effect of the release of the virus is to spread misinformation about the virus or misinformation about vaccinations or treatments or policies in order to fan the flames of public suspicion. So how could that be addressed, and to what extent is that a legitimate threat during an event such as Claydex? The development of medical countermeasures, as you would expect, is a big topic of discussion during Claydex, the development of vaccines in particular, the lack of capacity to rapidly develop vaccines for new viruses such as Claydex is certainly a concern. Also, the problem that we still don't have rapid point-of-care diagnostics for a lot of pathogens, a lot of viruses, not to mention, the viruses that are just emerging. So, what do we need to do from a policy perspective to streamline our vaccination development process even further? And what do we have to do from a policy perspective to get to this point where private corporations, manufacturers have an incentive to really focus on rapid point of care diagnostics? The rapid point of care diagnostics is something that, they've been talking about for decades now. They talked about the need for those during the Atlantic Storm exercise, earlier on in the 21st century, and it's now 2018 and we still have need of that technology. So from a manufacturing perspective, from a research and development perspective, what can we do to advance this? Along with the development and manufacturing of medical countermeasures, there's also the question of distribution. Once you have a vaccine in hand, even if it's a limited amount, how do you go about distributing that initial supply of vaccine to the public? How do you decide whom to prioritize? Do you focus on those Americans that are responsible for maintaining critical infrastructure, such as the electrical grid and water safety and communications and things of that nature? Do you vaccinate all those people first? Do you vaccinate certain elected officials to protect them from the virus? Do you focus on vulnerable citizens, particular vulnerable groups such as pregnant women, the elderly, children, people with immune deficiency disorders, things like that? To what extent should the military be prioritized to make sure that we maintain national security capabilities? So this question of prioritization comes into play, but as part of that conversation, there was this element of, what is the American public going to find acceptable in these situations? Is the American public going to be willing to accept the vaccinating of members of Congress before members of their family? Are they going to see the logic behind that? Are they going to see that there's a need for that? Or are they going to look at that and say it's the politicians protecting themselves as opposed to protecting the people that they were elected to represent? And what are the potential repercussions of that? But at the same time, to what extent should public reaction be incorporated into this decision making? You know, should we be making these decisions based on the best scientific evidence? Should we be making these decisions based on a kind of cold, rational policy analysis? Or should public opinion play a role here? So that's another consideration. Sort of going along with one of the initial themes that we talked about, which was the ability of world leaders to trust scientists and to trust their scientific recommendations. There's also just the general level of knowledge that world leaders hold on pandemic issues. Recurring events. During the 21st century already, we've had SARS, we've had H1N1 influenza, we've had Ebola, we've had Zika. We've had every few years there's been a health emergency with potential global consequences there. So we have those frequent reminders, and then we also have these regular exercises, kind of high profile exercises like CLADEX, which are meant to keep these issues on the agenda and to help world leaders to gain more knowledge and gain more understanding of these issues. So, there are plenty of opportunities for leaders in the United States and leaders around the world to get their minds around these issues. But of course, politicians, have to deal with a range of different issues. Oftentimes they can't afford to focus too much on any one particular issue. And then there's the issue of politicians, change over time. People retire, people don't get reelected. Presidents change, obviously, every 4 to 8 years. So how do we address the fact that, to a certain extent, the leaders in the United States and the leaders around the world are kind of relearning lessons of the past all the time? And if you look at, for example, the Atlantic Storm exercise and you look at CLADEX, there are some similarities in terms of the conversation that takes place, and there are similarities in terms of the recommendations. So in terms of what we need to do to make ourselves safer from these sort of global emergencies, those recommendations haven't changed all that drastically between 2005 and 2018. And yet, we're not able to focus enough attention and enough public will to move these things forward. So how could we potentially, from a policy perspective, from a public perspective, accomplish that? The need for additional surge capacity in the healthcare system, especially in the United States, I won't speak for the global community, but I mean, U.S. hospitals and the U.S. healthcare system in general, much of it is for profit, and many of the institutions that we have in the U.S. operate on a very slim profit margin that don't leave a lot of room for stockpiling of resources and don't leave a lot of room for surge capacity, leaving a certain number of hospital beds unoccupied in case there's some kind of health emergency. So how do we address the need to have this surge capacity in the United States, in our hospitals, in our different kinds of health clinics and different kinds of health providers, despite the fact that from a business perspective, it's not worthwhile for hospitals and these facilities to carry this over the long term. And we've seen the repercussions, we've seen the effects of the lack of surge capacity recently with the last flu season. We had hospitals overwhelmed with flu patients coming to the emergency room, setting up, basically tent cities and parking lots. We had hospitals putting their emergency rooms on diversion because, they were just getting swamped with patients and couldn't take on anymore. So this is not just an issue for a situation like Clade X. This is becoming an issue on kind of a regular basis with flu season, which we know is going to come around on an annual basis, and flu season seems to be getting longer in some respects. So this could become an even bigger issue moving forward that we need to address. Since Clade X, according to the scenario, was a bioengineered pathogen, there's a question from a policy perspective of, do we need to do more to regulate kind of do-it-yourself genetic engineering? There's been lots of discussion in the media. There was a New York Times story not too long ago about these sort of do-it-yourself gene editing kits that people can get, and the potential for negative repercussions, either these kits falling into the hands of terrorists or people who want to do harm, or maybe people not intending to do harm but just accidentally releasing something that they've created. There seems to be some consensus that a lot of the people who have these kinds of kits don't necessarily have the skills to do anything major with the technology. But there's always the risk that it will fall into the wrong hands. So how can we regulate this area to still allow for some positive outcomes for people who potentially could do good with this technology, but mitigating the risk involved? There's a lot of intergovernmental concerns that factor into the Clade X discussion when it comes to the United States. There are events that happen during Clade X that make it clear that local events can very quickly become international in scope. One example that I'll give is at one point a college is quarantined by a local health official, which has international consequences because the college has international students. So when the local official quarantines the school and refuses it to allow any of the students to leave, then the diplomats from the countries that the international student population are from can say, well, this is, you're illegally detaining our citizens, and, we want our citizens to be able to leave so they can return home, but the local official has denied that. How to try to avoid these sorts of situations where local officials are potentially creating international incidents without considering the ramifications of what they're doing before they actually do it. On the alternative side of that is the idea that local authorities are not always properly consulted or properly involved with sort of higher level preparedness exercises or higher level preparedness discussions. On one hand, local officials could potentially exacerbate problems, but on the other hand, part of the reason why those circumstances can occur is because the federal government doesn't do enough to sort of involve them in these discussions and make them aware of some of these ramifications. So how can we incorporate state and local officials into those higher level discussions to avoid these issues in advance? Another intergovernmental relations issue is how can questions of whether or not to federalize quarantines or otherwise empower the federal government to directly take control of a situation be decided? When the quarantine, the local quarantine is instituted on the college, one of the things the officials involved in the CLADEX exercise discuss is whether or not the quarantine should be federalized, whether or not the federal government should just take control of the quarantine rather than having to monitor it and kind of try to make sure it doesn't get out of control. And there are different sides to the issue. One side is, if the federal government takes control, then the federal government is in a better position to manage some of these national and international implications. At the same time, if the federal government has to take control of every quarantine that occurs around the United States, because the federal government can't necessarily preclude local governments and states from engaging in quarantines, but if the federal government has to be responsible for all of those quarantines, do they lose kind of the big picture? Do they lose their ability to sort of monitor the bigger global situation? And then last but not least, certainly not least, because this is an issue that's of a special interest to me, and it's not something that is discussed explicitly and extensively during CLADEX, but I think it kind of underlies all of the other discussion, because all of the sorts of activities and needs that need to be addressed will require money, will require funding. And we've seen from some recent experiences, like the delay that Congress had in providing funding for the Zika response, that the federal government is not always quickly forthcoming with money to deal with public health emergencies. And that's led to many people in the public health community, in the healthcare community, to call for the creation of a public health emergency fund, modeled after the fund that the Federal Emergency Management Agency uses to respond to natural disasters. So that when an event like Zika, or when an event like CLADEX, or something in between occurs in the United States, that federal, state, and local health agencies are able to respond quickly and effectively without having to wait for a supplemental appropriation, without having to deal with that kind of uncertainty of how much are we going to be able to do, how much funding are we actually going to have. So again, if you watch the CLADEX exercise, this isn't something that's discussed explicitly, but it is an underlying issue, and it's something that I would anticipate talking about on this podcast a lot more in the future. So in conclusion, thanks for listening. Please listen to the two following episodes with Dr. Toner and Dr. Toner and Dr. Watson. I think the discussion there is very illuminating, and I hope you will tune in for additional episodes in the future. If you have any comments, I'd be glad to have those comments as well. You can find contact information in the show notes. So thank you very much. And again, thanks for listening.